The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with FBD Insurance. Home cover you can trust. See what you can save on fbd.ie.
Thank you, Susan. And we will start our lyrics competition now. So Boyzone are celebrating 25 years together with a farewell tour, and they'll be playing Dublin's Three Arena this January. So on today's lyrics competition, I'll be giving away a pair of tickets and access to the 1878 Private Members Club at Three Arena via its private entrance before the show, with dinner and a bottle of wine at your reserved table in the build-up. And after the show, you can go back to the 1878 to enjoy some of that unbeatable after-show atmosphere. So to win, you know the drill, I'll read out three sets of lyrics, and only when I've read out the third lyric, you can text song names to 51551. So here is the first Boyzone lyric. And I never know, girl, if I should stay or go, because the games that you play keep driving me away. Now, we were talking to John Kenny earlier about losing his dad at a young age, and the memories and everything else. And I suppose child-parent relationships are kind of complicated ones at the best of times. But what happens if the relationship is cut short and it's frozen in time due to the sudden death of a parent? So we're going to explore this now with John Teeling, whiskey magnate and entrepreneur, Virginia Kerr, international soprano and performance psychologist, and Daniel McConnell, political editor of the Irish Examiner. And all three lost a parent in their teenage years. Guys, you're all very welcome.
Morning, Brendan. Good afternoon.
Danny, tell us about your mum. She was an artist, a bit of a rebel, I get the sense.
Yeah, she was a wonderful woman. She was a brilliant artist, and she went to UCD, and she was at the forefront. There was a protest in the 1960s of women who were not allowed to wear trousers to college, but there was a protest, and I vividly remember that she was on the front page of either the Evening Press or the Irish Press, walking down the steps of Earlsford Terrace, proudly defying the the ban. And she, she was just a warm, amazing person. She had six kids in the house, so it was a busy household, but our kitchen table was a white kind of veneered table, and she would always be doodling with her pencil when all her pals were coming in. Yeah. And, she was just, like, the house, just, she was the centre of everything in the house, really.
Yeah, yeah. Virginia, you sound like you had quite an idyllic childhood.
Yeah, I'd like to think so. Yeah, I think I did. But then my mother died when I was 14.
But before your mother died, you grew up, you had the house were racing stables.
Yes, it was racing stables and a stud farm and a bloodstock agency and all that. And it was a big house in the country, and I had my pony, and, we all had our horses and all that. So it was idyllic, but I was lucky because we had a lot of people working in our house. Yeah. And I had a wonderful person who came when I was a year old to be a nursery governess. It all sounds terribly Victorian. Yeah. And she came, and she was with me until I was nine. And then she had to go home to Kerry to look after her parents. But she stayed very much part of our family, and she is still part of my family. And she comes, if I go on tour, she'll come and join me somewhere, and she's a marvellous lady. Right. So I was very lucky that I had her.
Okay, and you had it. Yeah. There was a big support structure.
It was a very big support structure.
And John, you didn't have a governess when you were growing up. Tell us about your dad. Your dad was quite the entrepreneur, not surprisingly.
Really, he was late getting started. He didn't have a real job until he was in his 30s, so he became an insurance salesman, and was really only getting started when he died of a heart attack in his mid-40s. So it was a bit surprising. I was the eldest, so it was a huge shock. It happened in 10 minutes. You didn't have a chance.
And your mother was a very young woman.
37, widow.
Yeah. And Virginia, your mum died when you were how old?
I was 14. She was 45. Okay. But she had been, I remember hearing that she died of a brain tumour, and she apparently had had the brain tumour since I was 3, because I remember her being very ill a lot of the time.
Okay.
But with medicine now, I don't know if it's possible that you could survive that long with a brain tumour or whatever. I don't really know. It's a long time ago.
But you were aware growing up.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. And Danny, how old were you when your mum died?
I was 12 when mum died. She had been sick for about 18 months. She had lung cancer, so she had So I have vivid memories of her being in and out of the hospital. You know, back then the treatment was remove the lung and kind of recuperate, but there were a couple of false starts and stuff like that. Like, so I remember she was in and out, and then it was that Christmas of 91 that she came home. And we genuinely thought, the younger ones of us thought that she was, you know, on the road to recovery. But unfortunately, it was the, you know, she had been sent home because there was really nothing more that they could do. But they were, my dad's plan and my older siblings' plan was that they were going to tell us after the new year. You know, let's enjoy one last Christmas that we didn't know was the last Christmas. Let's enjoy that Christmas. But unfortunately, she died the morning of New Year's Eve. So they never really got a chance to tell us.
And I know I'm big outstanding memory for you, and one that must have tormented you for a long time, I can well imagine, was the last conversation you had with your mum.
Yeah, I wrote about this. I did a piece in the Examiner a number of weeks ago, and it's the piece that most people have said to me, like, they've had similar conversations with parents like that. You know, they didn't realise they were as sick as they were. I was 12, so myself and all my pals had talked about wanting to go to Frondeland, you know, this Christmas fun fair in Dublin. And my parents had said, no way, you're still too young. You guys will get up to all sorts of no good, absolutely not. And I threw a strop, as you do as your preteen. And so I was kind of, you know, I stayed in while I think the guys did go. And, you know, but then, you know, the next morning she was gone before we'd had a chance to patch it up. So it was something that did live with me. It was, on one level it seemed frivolous, so you didn't raise it with people, or you didn't know how to raise it, but yet quietly it was there the whole time.
I'd bet. Yeah, John, you must have been quite traumatised too by your father's death, because it essentially, not exactly, but it kind of happened in front of you, and it was quite dramatic, wasn't it?
It happened on a Sunday, you can remember it explicitly, Sunday evening around the dinner tea table, as it was at that time. There were four kids, my father and mother, about 5:45, I can remember it very well. And he suddenly got pains and got attacked and knew he was in trouble, and we all, of course, kids roared and shouted. He struggled out to another room and then just died in front of me there, you know, foaming at the mouth over about 10 minutes. It was extremely, I can remember it explicitly, 58 Whoa. Years later.
Yeah, yeah. Do you remember your mother dying?
I do, Virginia. Yes. I remember the morning that she was in hospital, and we had been up with her the night before, and I remember my father wrote our names down, there were the four of us, and he wrote the names down, and she kept calling me my sister's name and getting us mixed up. And I was getting quite upset about this. But at the morning that she died in the afternoon. But my father, we got a call from the hospital at about 8:30 in the morning, and Dad, I answered it, and then Daddy went and took over. And they obviously had said to him that things were not good, and he was taking me to school, and he stopped the car and he started to cry, and that's the first time I'd ever seen him cry. But I don't think I still quite took it in. And then when we were collected from school, and when I came home, I was told that she had died. She died at 3:00 in the afternoon.
And tell me, do you remember then, as a child, do you remember grieving, or do you remember what that was like?
Not particularly for a while. I remember thinking, oh my God, you know, what's the funeral going to be like, or something like that. And then it was only afterwards, about 6 months later, I got appendicitis and I was in hospital and I wouldn't come home.
Okay.
And I think now, looking back on it, of course, this is what it was. But it took ages for them to get me to come home.
Yeah. John, I presume you remember the funeral and the aftermath. And all
well,
that.
I do, again, very clearly. It was 2 days which are exciting, and I thought using that word was just very busy. But
so,
I remember,
so you're jollied along.
Yeah,
by
the Tuesday afternoon, it wasn't after as big things at that stage. Everybody was gone, and my mother was there with the four of us, and my cousin, I remember it very clearly. And suddenly I said, my God, it's quiet, and you know, my father's never coming back. And I think that was the first time I really accepted that there was a huge loss there.
Yeah, yeah. And what was the impact on the family then?
I think afterwards was very much, we just had to knuckle down, because it wasn't state support, and my father was a commission agent, so my mother had to adapt, and I had to step up to it at 14 and help, as you
so
do.
So you were the man of the house then?
Literally, yes. And my brothers subsequently after us, they all stood up and did it as well. But there was no choice, because it was a question, you had to, you only ate what you killed, if you like, at that particular time, and there wouldn't have been any money there. So she had to take over the insurance book, and we had a tiny business which I tried to run at that time, and with her help. And but there was no alternative. Now she was a lady from the country, hadn't got much education, was very young. But she, you know, what else could you do? You did. Yeah. And the other kids, I think the four of us helped her as best we could. I'm sure we didn't, but we thought we were doing well.
Yeah. Danny, what was the impact in your family? I presume for a man to be left alone with six.
It's very daunting, I thought. And looking back in reflection from my dad, I think he probably was overawed by it. And I think John's description of that time around the funeral, ours was always a very busy house with six of us anyway.
Yeah.
But I do remember vividly that sort of the commotion stopping, you know, the knocks on the door kind of stopping to a certain degree, and just realising that, you know, and even stuff, you know, she died in her bedroom, so that, you know, the room was still pretty much untouched, and that sort of stuff kind of still lingering a couple of weeks afterwards. But I have to say, we were very lucky. Her she had a very tight group of pals who were really good to us, who would look at, particularly the two younger of us, myself and my younger brother Matt. We kind of were brought out on a lot of, you know, like brought to the cinema, brought to, you know, the theatre, the shows or whatever like that. So we were probably minded most in a way. But still, it just, obviously, the impact was just tremendous on the house. You know, it befell to the kids. Dad was never the most organised of individuals, so the running of the house sort of fell to my elder sister, Samantha, who was brilliant, who really well organised. But the impact was just immense, because you, very young household, very, I think we were very innocent and naive as well, Brendan. You know, we didn't really understand what this meant, how to properly deal with it, how to even initiate proper conversations around it, because, you know, you could feel sad, but what does that actually mean? And, you know, you're trying not to be a burden either, like, you know.
And yeah, so you wouldn't, you and your dad wouldn't have talked about it?
Not a huge amount at that stage. And, you know, as most teenage boys do, they kind of have a tricky enough relationship with their dads anyway, because you're growing up anyway. But it was just never easy, I think, to really kind of have the sort of, can we get to grips with what all of this means, you know, the significance of what has happened, and also just simply to sit back and remember her, the wonderful woman that was.
Yeah, yeah. Virginia, your family and the impact, how did your dad manage in keeping things going in that?
He was wonderful, but my father was very Victorian, so, you know, everybody had to be in black. So right. Now, because I was 14, so I was at school, so I got away with a bit more. But and my younger brother was only six, but the two older ones had to go and be in black, and we weren't allowed to have the radio on. We weren't allowed to have the record player, as it was at that time, or anything like that. So it was quite difficult. But he was a very we were a very close knit unit, the five of us, the four kids and him, for a long, long time after that.
Yeah. And do you think that, did you cope well psychologically and everything?
I think so. But I think it's only in adulthood that things come back. You know, I kind of think, you know, she never heard me sing. She never was able to come to a concert. I do a lot of classical music cruises. She would have loved that, because they used to go cruising a lot. So she would have loved that sort of thing. So, and it's, I love meeting people who knew her, because... Yeah. I don't really have that, you know, I have lots of memories, but, you know, I like to hear, tell me what she was like, what, you know, what would she have done in this situation?
And so is there a sense then of missing out? There is.
Oh, huge. Yeah, yeah. There's always something missing. And I remember one Christmas when I was about three, one of my earliest memories was going down Wicklow Street, and I was, they were on either side of me, and they were kind of swinging me along. And I remember being very, very happy, and they were very happy. And Christmas for me, and I never really realised why until I did a lot of work with the psychology, obviously.
Yeah.
I didn't realise why Christmas, there was always something missing. We had lovely Christmases, but there was always something missing. And then when I realised, yeah, it's that security, that unconditional love that was there for me, and the security and the safety of that. And that was gone then.
Yeah. John, what were the times when you missed your dad?
It's funny, I'm not sure that you could have missed him that much in the early years, because there was a question of surviving. And my sister was four. So it was probably about 20 years, you know, because by the time my mother managed to get everybody through education. And I think so I had my own kids and probably didn't realise it. And I think in recent years, when I see how well my children have played with their children. So as a grandfather, I probably see what I missed with my father and what he missed.
Yeah.
But certainly for about 20 or 25 years, you were working yourself, you're making your own way in life. The family was still going.
Yeah.
My mother lived for 48 years as a widow. So it was difficult to know at that time. You know, there was always things going on and you didn't really have a chance to miss them.
Didn't you? You did have one defining moment. It was November after he died and you were out collecting the books. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, it's funny. It's probably, I think, the most defining moment in anything I've managed to do over a long active life is we had this insurance book, so you had to collect the premiums every week, like a shilling or 2 shillings. And it was November and it was cold and it was wet. And I had to go to Home Farm Road in the north side, which was up the top of Griffith Avenue. And I was leaving Joey's, which was down in Fairview. And it was 4:30. I remember it explicitly now. And I really didn't. I was doing the intern. I thought I should be going home and maybe study, but nice warm house. The choice was either to go home and tell my mother, make an excuse, or to cycle all the way up Griffith Avenue in the rain and the wind. It was probably not very windy or anything. I think it was now.
Yeah, yeah.
And go to, I know the house, I could bring it to you now, collect 2 and 6 months, which was a big premium in 1960. I couldn't go home to her without doing it. I just couldn't.
Mm.
And that was the defining moment. After that, I never thought there was something I couldn't do after that. I did it. And then, I don't know if you know Griffith Avenue, it's all downhill. Yeah. Going back, it's true. It is. All the way back was easy. And my whole life has been defined by that.
Right. And Danny, do you have moments where you miss her still?
Absolutely.
Did you feel cheated?
Well, I think back to my wedding day, Brennan, and I think back to the birth of my kids, like my 2 kids, and I see the wonderful interaction Eliza and Sam, my little ones, have with my wife's parents, who are still around and are brilliant with them. And, you know, that obviously plays a part. And,
Yeah, okay. You know the way John said there that moment there where he did that thing that kind of defined his whole life. Does it define who you are as a person if something like that happens to you when you're young?
It certainly has a huge impact on you. I don't know whether it defines you or not, but it certainly completely alters your life path, I think, because I think you're just a completely different person. The biggest signpost, Brenna, or the biggest surprise I've gotten since I wrote the piece was the number of people who've come up to me and said, who are in the same boat, be they politicians, political advisors, other journalists, even people from my local pub where I stop in for a pint, will say, I read your piece, I'm in exactly the same boat. And it does change your mindset on life. And I often think of, you know, Bono, the singer in U2, wrote about Iris's mother, like, and the impact, the void that left in his life. I would feel that he was kind of speaking my language a bit when he wrote about that, you know.
And he talked about a very angry household that she left behind. Then, and three men at loggerheads with each other. He also, is it in that song or in one of the songs from that album, he says the reason he knows there's no end to love is because there's no end to grief.
Mm,
is there no end to it?
It's always with you.
You're nodding, Virginia.
No, there isn't an end to it. You know, I think you get to the stage where you accept the loss and you move on because you have to, because you haven't any choice. Mm. But it never really goes away. You just bring the person with you. But I think for children, sometimes with the adults in the house, say the spouse that's left behind, can sometimes get engulfed in their own grief and there might not be space for the children. Mm. And that gets buried a little bit. And hopefully it's not like that anymore. But at one stage, there might not have been so much awareness of counselling and grief counselling, and that kids need the space, whether they're tiny and they're doing art therapy or sound therapy or something, or whether they're a bit older and they're actually being allowed to have a safe space that they can talk about what this is like for them.
Okay, and any other tips on what we should be doing for kids in this situation?
Listening.
Yeah.
Yeah, listening, watching out. A lot of the time with children, they'll act out, you know, and you can see, like, I was acting out in the hospital that time when I wouldn't come home.
Okay.
So it's listening.
But I think, I mean, I refer to Sister Helen Culhane. She runs the Children's Grief Centre in Limerick. And I was listening to her on Sean O'Rourke talk about the sort of interaction that I would have benefited massively from had it been in place when I was growing up. That sort of safe haven.
Yeah.
You know, with that, it's not a relative. It's not, you know, like, I think my aunt and uncle, my uncle David and my aunt, they were a huge refuge for us. It was a safe space to step out of. But this sort of objective, someone who's not related to your family to step into, you know, and just like, because a lot of kids, they either blame themselves, like as I did to a certain degree, you know, did I play, did my, that row have some role in my mum dying? Ridiculous now looking back on it, but you do ask yourself those questions. But also as well, in other circumstances, you know, did she not love me enough to, you know, why did she not stick around? All these sort of questions that a lot of kids will ask themselves completely irrationally, but they need a safe place to ask them. And I just think surely there needs to be a scheme or something like that, that if a kid under a particular age has been bereaved, they have to at least go to see somebody. They might not, it might not suit them, but at least they have the option of it, I would think.
Yeah, okay. And also they can, they don't have to mind, like kids will be minding their parents or them, who the parent that's left, and won't want to say I'm upset because it'll upset mummy or it'll upset daddy or whatever. Whereas if it's with somebody who's trained to do this, and if it's with a grief therapist or something, they don't have to mind that person. So they can say just how awful it is, and it's in a safe environment. Mm. Okay. You know?
So just to end on a little bit of a positive note, John, clearly though, the experience of having known your father when he was alive and then have his death and the way that pushed you in life and everything, I suppose it has made you the man you are, hasn't it?
And you're hugely successful person. I think it's a shocking thing to say, and I've often thought about that. I think absolutely true. In our case, I maybe it was me, is I just accepted it and had to get on with it. There wasn't much point in really grieving or doing anything. It had to be done. And many times over my career, I faced situations and say, hey, look, this has to be done. Just go and do it. And I think that experience has given me that strength and the self-confidence to be able to do that.
Okay. Well, look, I think the one key message that would be helpful to anyone coming out of this anyway is that the kids in this situation should definitely go talk to someone and that people should listen to them. Okay, look, thank you very much, all of you. John Teeling, Virginia Kerr and Daniel McConnell. Take a break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.